Okay, let me get out of the way. Thank you to Bill very much for the invitation to this conference. The whole issue of archiving, remembering cultural artifacts has been central to my work for a number of years. I used to work as an archivist for the Australian government in Canberra. I was director in the late 80s of a group called the National Archive for the History of Computing in Manchester. Well, we didn't quite have the principles well worked out, that we had an agreement with the Science Museum in London that they would do the hardware and we would do the software. So we had all the software but nothing to run it on, and they had all the hardware but no software to run it on. Clearly, there are interesting questions of materiality, of the relationship with the artifact, both the electronic artifact through the computer interface, as well as the more traditional question of the relationship with the book, the feel of the page, which gave Charles Lamb such sexual pleasure, and of course anthrax, outbreaks of anthrax in the 19th century through the putrid serum of sheep's blood that was used in bookbinding, the glue in bookbinding. The physical nature of the book itself has a lot of reality. It's integral to the process of reading a book in many ways. Now, clearly with electronic documents, you're not going to be just reproducing the original experience of reading. Who would want the original experience of playing Pong, for example, which was so hard on the eyes, so difficult to follow, but such a good game. An emulation is clearly going to be very different, but it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to carry a lot of useful information. Now today, I'm going to do something basically completely useless as far as the suggesting any good modes of preservation or anything like that goes. What I want to do is give some general thoughts that I've developed over the years about the act of remembering, the act of memory, mediated through documents, either electronic or textual, or artifacts, cultural artifacts like pipes or antelopes. And I also want to talk about forgetting and the virtues of forgetting over the ages. I think rot is probably as good a word as forgetting. What rot does is that it creates a hummus, you know, a new soil out of which other things can grow. So I want to talk about the interplay of rot and remembering in the development of very large-scale cultural, social, political archives. So I'm going to be talking about the archive, and I'm going to use that for shortness's sake. I'll use it quite simply in Derrida's term, in Derrida's definition, which he gave an archive fever. The French is mal d'archive. He says there are two aspects to the archive. The archive is sequential. What this means is that it's from this point on that you are that the archive is founded. Let's give a simple example of that from the olden days. Clancy writes beautifully about it, and from memory to written record, that it was on some particular day, something like February 14th, 1159. It was from that date, from that one day, that you could henceforth describe a continuous series of notarial records which contain property information, property rights, transactions of all sorts. Before that was nothing. From that day on, that is the beginning. Now the other thing that's wrapped into the archive for Derrida, and I assume many of you already know this work, so I'm not going to go over it in detail. The other thing that's wrapped in is that it's jussive. It has a legal component. It is a commandment. It's like, it's the same root as arche, the Ark of the Covenant, which is held in the, uh, which is to remember the archive, to store it, to preserve it, to maintain it, and to act in accordance with the dictates of the archive. So archives in general are really central parts of our social, cultural, and material fabric. With the development of the new media, of electronic media, we've hit a point where we are rethinking our archive in certain, I think, fairly fundamental ways. And I want to talk about what I think are some of the most important of those ways. This is going to be my first talk for many years without PowerPoint, so let's hope it goes okay. All right, I'm going to start with two quotes. The first is from Thomas Pynchon, his wonderful novel, Mason and Dixon. He talks about, he has a quote from the Reverend Wicks Cherrycoat, who has written this thunderous series of sermons called Christ in History. And the quote goes, "Facts about the playthings of lawyers, tops and hoops, forever a spin. Alas, the historian may indulge in no such idle rotating. History is no chronology, for that is left to lawyers. Nor is it remembrance, for remembrance belongs to the people. History can as little pretend to the veracity of the one as claim the power of the other. Her practitioners, that is historians, to survive, must soon learn the art of the quidnunc, spy, and tapering wit, that they may ever continue more than one lifeline back into a past we risk, each day losing our forebears in forever. Not a single chain of great links, for one broken link could lose us all, rather a great disorderly tangle of lines, long and short, weak and strong, vanishing into the mnemonic deep, with only their destination in common." I find that an incredibly evocative quote for thinking through archives and the nature of archiving. We all know examples of there being just a single lifeline back into the past. Alexandria, the Library of Alexandria is a good case of that. There was just one lifeline. That cuts. We have to wait for the transmission of literature through the Arabs and then through the Moors in Spain, back into the centres of learning in Europe. The single lifeline is problematic. We want a great disorderly tangle of lines. We want many ways of being able to evoke and remember the past. The advantage of that is, firstly, redundancy means we don't lose shit, I mean, which is always nice. The second advantage of it is that it allows us to reconfigure the past, to re-understand, reinterpret our own past. The way that history has tended to get written, the way that storage has been done in libraries, the way that records have been kept one way or another in collections, has tended to be the history of the victors, the story of the victors, and also the story of victors' analyses of particular socio-cultural, political events. Sandy Burnham, the library cataloguer, has inveighed against the Library of Congress classification systems for years, precisely on the grounds of the difficulty within that system of unpacking stories that didn't fit into the master narratives at the time in which those books were classified or those classifications were produced. So, for example, you have a very different relationship between black literature and Polynesian literature within the Library of Congress. They're different kinds of thing. One fits under kind of straight cultural, the other fits under a different sort of heading. There's not symmetry between the treatment of the cultural groups. There's not symmetry about the treatment of women, for example. There's not symmetry about questions of race. There's a huge cultural narrative getting coded in there in the Library of Congress. And that has an effect. It has an effect in the sense that it makes certain kinds of books easy to find, certain kinds of books difficult to find. So I think that the point that I want to retain from that is just a really simple one. We not only need multiple ways back into the past, we We need ways of constructing multiple pasts, of keeping the past itself fluid, and not regarding the past as a fixed thing that we can store in a book or store in a CD-ROM or in a static form like that. If we follow that particular model, what we end up with at the end of the day is something very akin to the pipe on the wall in Lagrange, or the status of the ethnographic object for the Surrealists in Paris in the 1920s and 1930s, where they would take stuff brought back from Africa and South America, plonk it on the wall, and that's anthropological strangeness for you. We don't want and need that kind of memory. What we want and need is a memory which can hopefully allow us to take full advantage of the new technologies. I'm already going too slowly. Alright, the other quote I wanted to start with is from Clancy himself, who I think is, from memory to written record, is a superb site here for thinking through these issues. The shift, he says, from habitually memorizing things to writing them down and keeping records was necessarily prior to the shift from script to print, and was a profound change in its effects on the individual intellect and society. So this move that we write things down instead of holding our memory, that we rely on witnesses, that we don't rely on witnesses and witnessing and trustworthy people, but we rely on trustworthy documents guaranteed through tricks like chirographs, where you rip a document in two, cut it in a certain way, and then one half of the party takes one half, the other half takes the other, and then just join them together. So simple technologies that developed around writing. It took, as Clancy showed, about 200 years to develop a good suite of technologies to make it relatively trustworthy. This move to a trust in writing over a trust in people, it's huge. Massive effect on us at all social, cultural, and political levels. We're undergoing very similar shifts today as we move into the electronic world. This really is a fundamental change in our relationship with the past and in our relationship with our documents and our relationship with our culture. And I hope to develop some of that in the little time I have left. Okay. I rarely think about the traces that I leave in the world as an ecology. I tend to think of them, when at all, quite concretely. Firstly, my library. It operates as a form of external memory for me when I rarely use it, and as a commemoration of things I have read. Its probable fate after my death is its dispersal into 100 poems. Marginal notes that I have written will lower the selling price rather than attract attention. Now, this is me and my deal phase. On the web, it is interesting to track dead people on the web. My friends and acquaintances who died before Mosaic, the first browser, are sparsely represented. And when they are, it is generally in classic canonical academic style, footnote references, bibliographies, etc., or in a Mormon database. Those who died more recently carried on a rich afterlife. They often still receive email messages, links to their websites rot very slowly. Their informal thoughts are often captured on lists of archives, on comments they have left on a website, citing visitors' books. Some people even have eternal flame websites, where the problem of maintenance lies as it is for the Olympic torch. Each of these modes of memory were in place before Mosaic, but it is now possible to articulate them in ways that were previously unworkable. It would take a researcher a lifetime to track down my written traces, where I have signed guest books in weird museums and tween hostels, people I've carried on informal correspondence with. Those of us enjoying and being irritated by PMS, post-mosaic syndrome, leave legible traces across a wide range of our activities in electronic form. Everyone their own Boswell. When I rarely think about the articulation of the set of traces I'm leaving, I have the immediate apprehension that it's not the real me that's out there on the web. sense of myself, very problematic concept, and when I've performed actions to complement and frequently to confound a trace that I have left. Thus I might write a positive review of a friend's book, and then offer close colleagues a somewhat different reading. The traces that I use, the traces that I leave in it electronically, are part of my action in the world. They're not meant to represent me, they're not meant to represent my thought, purely and solely. What I'm pointing to here is something of the order of Benjamin's aura. What is it that surrounds a particular document? What is it that surrounds a trace? And how can we think about what surrounds a trace that makes it worth keeping or not? So the nature and virtues of rot, or forgetting, for the next few minutes. Consider the total institution. Mary Douglas argues that when everything is institutionalized, no history or other storage devices are necessary. If I get processed into a prison, I can survive there as just a number, as the Count of Monte Cristo discovered. There's no need for the institution to hold any information about me, other than that I exist and that I am subject to its regulations. When I am there, and why I am there and who I am just doesn't matter to the institution itself, the total institution. It remembers all it needs to know through the complex set of procedures that it puts into place. Shima Kin, a wonderful Chinese historian from the 2nd century BC, makes a similar observation about the burning of the books. Approving his proposals, the first emperor collected up and got rid of the songs, the documents, and the saying of the 100 schools in order to make the people stupid and ensure that in all other heaven there should be no rejection of the past by using the no rejection of the present by using the past. The clarification of laws and regulations and the settling of statutes and ordinances all started with the first emperor. He standardized documents. Actually, this is another example of this kind of archive move I was describing in the beginning. It's an inaugural act, we'll destroy everything in the past. Generally, destruction of past cultural archives happens quite simply through reclassification. So you've got my canonical example there is Lavoisier's Principles of Chemistry in the 1790s. He writes a book that gives us oxygen and all that good stuff, gives us new language for talking about the elements. So we've got nitrogen, oxygen, silver. Silver's a good example. No longer would you go into a library or whatever and look up moonstone, Diana's stone, all of these names for silver that are associated with alchemical knowledge, with different forms of knowledge. From the moment where we have Lavoisier's classification, that becomes the official classification, and that becomes the way in which we can afford to forget. Because we have to forget. We have to be able to forget. I should get on to that in a second. Okay. How much time? All right. I want to skip a little bit here.
2 or 3 minutes. So we'll have time for discussion.
Good. All right. 2 or 3 minutes. All right. Yes. Okay. I'm quoting here. Yeah, all right. So let me swing to another quote and then a conclusion. This is a quote about the keeping of written memories as part of a move to consolidate new power relations by partly creating false continuities and discontinuities with the past. The context here is I'm referring to, what's his name? Geary's book, Phantoms of Remembrance. Phantoms of Remembrance is about what happened basically to records and record keeping from the basically the turn of the last millennium, so over the period about 900 to 1100 in France. Before that period, it's again similar to Clanchy's period, knowledge about what was happening, about property rights, remembrance of families was held, generally women's knowledge held in the household and recounted through stories. It became something which was held by the monasteries in written records, and lives were remembered through masses which were paid. here in the arable, cutting down groves once sacred to the gods so that the land could be made useful for the present. This same pruning was going on in archives across the continent. This is in the 11th century. Both he and Paul of St. Peter Chartres emphasized that not everything was to be preserved, only that which was useful. So, I'm actually a lot in, I mean, so much of me likes the idea of rot and destruction and loss. I always feel that when I go into Italy, for example, where you see the houses with the murals on them, which are now fading away. You see the churches with the Browning paintings, which aren't going to survive that much longer. But it strikes me that it is part of a very vital culture that it's able to forget and destroy in useful and interesting ways. I think that's what makes Paris a much more interesting city than London, for example. London tries to preserve, Paris tries to grow organically. However, I think there's a wonderful potential with the electronic archive that we're in the process of creating. And that potential I would characterize by the phrase potential memory. And let me indicate what I mean by potential memory, and this will be my conclusion, Bob. Potential memory is the fact that you don't necessarily want to remember everything. I mean, who the heck does? When you take photos, you don't sit down and look at those photos time after time, year after year. Generally, they're mostly just thrown into a drawer somewhere before they get moved into an attic and get thrown away. However, if you can get access to those, new and interesting access that would allow you to rethink your past, that would be incredibly useful. And that is that ability to create a new past, to genuinely rethink your past. It's that flexibility to have a potential memory out there, a memory of things that maybe we should have remembered, but they weren't, on our radar screen as being cultural artifacts worth preserving. Maybe if we had that, then we could really take the past, and this is the political message, take the past out of the hands of victors in history and make it part of ongoing political, social and cultural struggles. Well, I think that's ridiculous enough to finish on, so thank you.